Tonight on Standing Room Only, infrastructure, immobilities, independence, and an Iraqi refugee. And Cheryl Dunier, Blurring Distinctions.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On February 20th, Refugee Studies doctoral student Lydia Leahy presented her paper on the refugee resettlement process in the Midwest through the analysis of the humanitarian practices by non-governmental organizations and community organizations. Specifically, she focused on the experience of Layla, an Iraqi refugee in Indianapolis. But that is just the first half hour. After that, award-winning filmmaker Cheryl Dunier speaks about her life and work.
I study refugee resettlement in Indiana, specifically in Indianapolis. And my work is on obstacles and barriers that refugees face that create mobility or immobilities for them throughout the city. And I'm looking at solutions that we can come across to stop these obstacles and barriers. So it's important to know who a refugee is and how they get here. So a refugee is anyone who is fleeing persecution, war, violence, and they can be registered through the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, which I call UNHCR, or everyone calls them UNHCR, or they can be unregistered. And still fleeing war, persecution, and violence like asylum seekers. So refugee is a blanket term, really, but refugees that come to the United States are registered through the UNHCR, and so that's what I'll be referring to when I talk about refugees here. So there are three main durable solutions when it comes to refugees. There are two others across the field of academia and policymakers, but I'm not going to discuss those because these are the three that are accepted by the U.S. and UNHCR, and they are resettlement, voluntary repatriation, and local integration. So resettlement, I'm going to use an example on Syria to explain each one. So if a refugee is from Syria, which would be their country of origin, or they go into a host country, say like Jordan, then they become a permanent citizen in a second or third country. So the second country would be their host country, Jordan. So Jordan would accept them as a permanent citizen. Or in the third country, which for this case would be the United States. So this is the vetting process it takes for a refugee to become resettled in the United States. The UNHCR has its own vetting process that takes usually about almost 2 years, and this one takes almost about 2 years as well. So in total, it's about 4+ year process for a refugee to come to the United States from being registered. And so voluntary agencies work through the State Department's Bureau of Populations, Refugees and Migrations. And refugees who come to the United States have to go through a voluntary agency to be resettled. So these are the nine only ones in the US, and they're spread out among different cities in the United States. And a refugee cannot be resettled in a city unless there is a voluntary agency already in that city. So Indianapolis has two voluntary agencies, and Fort Wayne has one, and Bloomington has zero. So we can't have refugees in Bloomington, but they can go to Indianapolis through the voluntary agency, and then maybe a few years later come down to Bloomington, and that's how they come here. So specific to Indianapolis, a refugee would go through. First, their information would go to the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Populations, Refugees and Migrations, then to the voluntary agencies, who would divide them up among the different branches they have among all states, and then they would go down to the local agency. So this row right here is all the local agencies in Indianapolis. There's Catholic Charities that resettles refugees, and then there's Episcopal Migration Ministries and Church World Service, who go through the subcontractor of Exodus Refugee Immigration. So Exodus is located in Indianapolis, and they're a subcontractor of those two local agencies who are not in Indianapolis, but they are in other cities, and then they subcontract to Exodus. So here are some specific statistics on refugees in Indianapolis. In And this is specific to Exodus. I do work with Catholic Charities as well, but my research focuses on refugees from Exodus and the resources they offer them. So I don't have anything against Catholic Charities, but these are just their statistics. So in 2016, Exodus resettled 947 refugees. 59% of them were Burmese, and 15% of them were Congolese, and 13% of them were Syrian. And then specific to this case study, 3% of them were Iraqi. So Indiana has the largest Burmese population of resettled refugees, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, actually has more Burmese refugees than Indianapolis, but they're still the largest resettled refugee group in Indianapolis. And then Congolese are the second largest, and then Syrian are the third largest for these past 2 years. So in 2017, their number got cut in almost in half at 501 refugees resettled, with 50% Burmese, 20% Congolese, 17% Syrian, and then again 3% Iraqi. So real quickly, that was all under resettlement. I'll go over repatriation. So repatriation is where, again with the Syria example, a refugee from Syria, their country of origin, is in a camp in a country of origin. So say they were in Damascus, they went to a camp in Idlib, or they go to a host country like in Jordan, and then they go back to their country of origin. And then reintegration, or also called local integration, is where country of origin, so a refugee from Syria, goes to a host country, Jordan, and then they get integrated into the Jordanian society there, because often the average length of stay of refugees in a camp is about 17 years, and so that's a long time, and then they get integrated into the society in Jordan. I'm going to read a short story about Layla, and then we'll get into this case study. It was the coldest day of the year in Indianapolis as Layla, a newly arrived Kurdish refugee in her 20s, practiced crossing an Indianapolis street with her transportation independence class instructor. She had to complete the basics of the class, walking independence, busing independence, and biking independence, before she could get to what she was really there for, driving independence. She was taking this 3-hour-a-day, 15-day class so she could have a better chance at passing the exam to obtain her learner's permit. Push the button below the walk sign on the pole. Wait until the light turns from the red hand to the white man, her instructor shouted through the harsh winter wind. Cross between the white lines, walk quickly, and don't stop in the street. Don't forget to always look both ways. When Layla left class at the end of the day, she started to cross the street, stopping in the middle of the street for 40 seconds as she waited for cars to pass in the other lane. As I observed this, I saw her perform this act of resistance by crossing in the middle of the street and stopping there, even though her instructor had just taught her not to. This was just the beginning for Layla. She did not yet know so many of the infrastructural obstacles that stood between herself and her learner's permit, and eventually her driver's license. So using Layla's story and data from other refugees in Indianapolis, I will discuss the infrastructural obstacles that refugees in Indianapolis face and the immobilities that these infrastructural obstacles create for these refugees. So the first one I want to discuss is linguistic infrastructure. Linguistic infrastructure contains both translation, which is translation of written language from one language to another, and interpretation, which is the translation of one spoken language to another spoken language. So they're a little different, but most people often just refer to it as translation. So without this linguistic infrastructure, there's a lot of miscommunication among refugees, because when a refugee comes to the U.S., they're also often coming from camps where they don't have prior English experience. And so if no one working with them speaks their native language, then a lot of miscommunication happens, and they might not go to the right place, or they don't know how to get to school and stuff like that. So this is Luna Language Services. And as you can see, they're super refugee positive. They actually hire prior refugees to work for them as translators and interpreters for the company. However, they're expensive, both the costs they require for these services and to work for them, they're expensive as well. So the guy in the middle and the guy to the right there, they were both prior refugees in Indianapolis. And they had to go through a certification process to be hired by Luna Language Services. And the certification process was $5,000 of classwork to pass before they could start working for Luna and then making a monthly income. So not only are their services expensive, but it's also expensive to work for them as well. Well, at first, and then eventually you get salary and an income. So aside from Exodus, many other organizations that work with refugees in Indianapolis use friends and family members of refugees for interpretation and translation. One example is the Indianapolis Public School System. They had this family who came, this little girl, she started going to school, and neither the little girl nor the mother spoke any English whatsoever. So they invited another family who had been going to that school from the Congo as well, from 5 years prior, to come translate and interpret for the newly arrived refugees who are going to the school. So that's often common. And then IPS, the Indianapolis Public School System, ended up hiring them like this just hourly job whenever new refugees came and they needed Kinyarwanda and Kiswahili translation done. So yeah, use of family and friends for translation and interpretation is great, and it's also a lower rate, and it helps support refugees who have been there for a while by giving them an extra income other than their regular employment. So in transportation classes, Jennifer, the transportation course instructor, she needed Luna Language Services to come and give interpretation, translation resources to the refugees who are taking this class. In the class, it was Layla, the Iraqi Kurdish refugee, and a few Burmese women who spoke Chin. So there were two interpreters there. And Jennifer stressed that English was not the primary goal of the class because she wanted the refugees to feel comfortable learning about the laws and the rules of transportation in Indianapolis and how to walk properly, bike properly, drive and everything in Indianapolis. So that was really great because it made Layla and the Burmese woman feel very comfortable in the class. But then again, I think that it might have been more useful if they were learning vocabulary in English. So that way later on, they could maybe take their driver's test in English and recognize the vocabulary after much practice. But these paid interpreters, they were hired as interpreters, but they also had to do translation services, which was an extra fee then because they needed to like translate written documents for the refugees and practice exams that they were given out and everything. So another example of linguistic infrastructure, not yet, sorry. This is a really long slide, I'm so sorry. Should have added more pictures. Is English as a new language and English as a second language classes. So these classes are spread out all across Indianapolis. All organizations are excited to offer these classes for refugees, including the public library, employment agencies, Morales Group, which is a provider of employment and financial literacy for refugees. So they're all across Indy, but the problem is they're not near where refugees live. So Morales Group recognized this, and what they did was they gathered all 70 organizations in Indianapolis that worked with refugees for a monthly town hall meeting. And at this monthly town hall meeting, what they did was they discussed the different gaps that existed with the resources they were providing for refugees, and that was it. They just discussed the gaps. Through my past 2 months of attending the town hall meetings, there were really no like solutions to any of these, except for when I did one-on-one interviews with different people who were there. They had their own solutions but didn't bring them up at the meetings. So Indianapolis Public School Systems is one of the examples that came up. They're far away and they offer English as a new language classes free for refugees. But to get there, refugees have to be confident in transportation, like busing, walking, biking, and they need sometimes an interpreter to get there and explain what they're there for as well, because there has been miscommunication in the past. So, yeah, moving on to transportation independence now, or infrastructure. So Lisa Maliki is my favorite anthropologist who works with refugees and humanitarian aid. And what she has done in the past is talked about the white savior complex, as well as the different ways that volunteers and organizations have worked with refugees. An example of this is how volunteers in Finland tried to make themselves and occupy their time by knitting teddy bears for refugee children, thinking that refugees need children need toys to play with, something to cuddle, to comfort them, support them. But she argues that instead of these gifts helping the refugees that they're given to, they are helping the providers of them by giving them the self-assurance and idea that they are making a difference in someone's life. So I see this happening as well in Indianapolis with different organizations, employers, and even the resettlement agencies themselves. So on the first day of class, the first sentence Jennifer said was, "If you show up on time for every class and come every day, we will then give you a gift, a bicycle." So this gift I see as being a burdensome gift, causing more immobility than mobility that she might have thought it caused or created. So as Layla explained to me later on, riding a bicycle in her culture is culturally inappropriate because women can't ride bicycles. And she said that if she was still living with her parents, she would never have ridden a bicycle because it was a taboo. But since she was living with her husband, she said she would accept it anyway and do it. So along with this, transportation infrastructure in Indianapolis is not set up for biking, really. So Indianapolis is a large city. And as many of you know, 465 goes all the way around it. And refugees often pretend this is Indianapolis. Refugees often live down in this corner, and their places of employment are up in this corner. So that's Greenwood, and that's a city I don't know. So biking paths and sidewalks exist usually just in this general area in the downtown area, but they don't exist on the outskirts of the town. So it's not safe to bike there for refugees. And plus, in the transportation class, they're only taught how to bike in a bike lane or like at a park and not on a regular street. So along with that, going back to that example of where they live and where they work, that is a 21-mile drive or bike, however you choose to go. And according to Google Maps, if you want to go from home to work, that's 2 hours and 14 minutes of biking. So if you want to do that, you can leave really early in the morning and like 2 hours before your shift and then get there. And then you leave and you get home 2 hours after your shift ends. And during these times, the sun sometimes, especially in the winter, it will be down. So that requires like this extra purchase refugees will have to make that they've learned about to buy bike lights and bright colors to wear. So that way they're safe on the roads and the little amount of bike lanes that there are. And finally, like I mentioned before with biking, there's no formal instruction on how to bike, not on a bike path. So if you're biking on a road, you're probably gonna be doing some things like you're not supposed to. Like you're supposed to stay 3 feet at minimum away from a car in front of you. So, and that's something they weren't taught in the class. So then right after she said that, she continued with, "If you complete this course and have a level 3 in English, then Exodus will pay for some of your driving instruction hours with an instructor if you already have your learner's permit." So there's a few problems here I'd like to discuss. The first one is level 3 of English. I asked Jennifer what level 3 was, and she said it's an advanced low. And if you look at what that requires, it's control of the grammar and vocabulary to get around every day. So she should know that since they're having interpreters and this is literally their first month in the country and they have no prior English instruction before, that they would not have been at this level 3 of English yet. And then along with the learner's permit, in Indiana, to get your learner's permit, you have to pass a written exam, which is in English. So going back to what I said before, this is why I think it would have been useful to give some vocabulary in English during the transportation class. So that way they would have a better chance at getting their learner's permit, which is something Layla said that she struggled with a few times. To this day, she still doesn't have her learner's permit, but that's okay. She'll get there. So when a refugee does obtain a learner's permit, They have crossed all the language barriers for getting a driver's license, but getting the driver's license is the biggest hurdle that they have to cross to become transportation independent in Indianapolis. So some of the hurdles to get a driver's license after the permit is driving practice. So I know it's different in every state, but specifically to Indiana, it requires 50 hours of day driving and 10 hours of night driving. And then on top of that, it has to be with a licensed driver over 25 years old who is related by blood, marriage, or legal status to you. So not only is that 60 hours of your time that you have to put into this away from like working and doing things with your family, but that's also 60 hours of someone else in your family's time that they have to put into this as well. So Layla said she's often heard of other refugees just lying on their driving practice thing, saying that they did all the hours so that way they can just get their driver's license afterwards. Walking is one of the most used modes of transportation among refugees in Indianapolis, aside from carpooling. This was said by Stephanie Plock. It's just blurry to begin with. I'm sorry, I'm really bad at pictures. This was said by Stephanie Plockus, who is a master's student at IUPUI, and she has done her work on refugee resources, which is very similar to mine. So this map is on the south side of Indy. So as you can see, here is 465, and then down here is Greenwood, and those are resources. And so she's tried to map out the resources to show refugees where they need to go to get the resources they need and everything. So she has one for the south side, which is primarily where the Burmese refugees live, and then one for the east side, which is primarily where the Congolese refugees live. So walking also has its infrastructural barriers as well. So like, it's very similar to biking. If the refugees are living down here and they are working, like this is 465. So like where they work is up there where those pipes are. So it's just really blown up. That's gonna take a lot more than the 2 hours it takes to bike. And then along with walking, the way that they're taught in the transportation class is to use Google Maps. And Layla and the Burmese woman in this class, they had cell phones, but they didn't have data plans. So they had to be connected to Wi-Fi to use Google Maps. And not only did they not have data plans, they didn't have cell phone plans, period. So they just used their phones, like I use an iPod, to connect to Wi-Fi and use WhatsApp to communicate with people. So they couldn't text people or call people like off of Wi-Fi at all. So if they're walking and they don't have this data plan or cell phone plan, they're gonna have trouble with directions. And Layla said she always had trouble like asking for directions whenever she got lost because her English was really bad and she was confused right and left. And organizations also often assume that refugees have this access to the data plans when they actually don't. So finally, with this data plan thing, if you're taking a bus, the bus schedules and bus maps and bus information on arrival and departure time is all accessed through the app on your phone. I mean, you can also use a computer, but Layla and the Burmese women didn't have computers at all. So they wouldn't be able to access the knowledge of when the bus would be coming and dropping them off so they could know when they needed to leave and arrive somewhere. So that Jennifer, the class transportation class instructor, then suggested after they told her this, that they can use this cool thing that the Indianapolis public transportation system has, which is called Indigo, has. They have this thing where you can text your stop number and it'll show you what time the buses will arrive and at what time those buses will arrive at other stops along the way. But they still didn't have a like phone plan to access this. So Layla said that this was her biggest struggle because she hated waiting in the cold snow outside for like an hour or so to wait for the bus to get where she was going. So she also said her biggest worry in life was to always miss the bus because then she would have to wait an extra hour. So I think that the data infrastructure causes another immobility that hasn't often been discussed among refugees in Indianapolis. So the last one I want to talk about is financial infrastructure. Money and finances are another large immobility that refugees face when they are resettled in cities in America, because resettlement agencies usually pay the rent and the bills for refugees for up to 3 months after resettlement. But refugees often have to make tough decisions on what they should and should not spend money on in terms of their transportation or in terms of their data plans or anything. So, bus tickets. Bus tickets here, we're all privileged. We are students. We don't have to pay for the buses, but refugees do. So a bus ticket is like $2 to $3 in Indianapolis, but you can buy a monthly pass, which is $60. And so if you're using the bus every month to go from home to work and back, that's about $720 a year, which is a sacrifice refugees have to consider if they want to do that or not, or spend their money on other things like food and water and rent and bills or family. And so, but refugees often come in families of 4 to 7 to Indianapolis. And so if more than just you needs to ride the bus, that's about $3,600 for about 4 members of your family to ride the bus to and from work. Yeah, that's a lot. So it's something refugees have to consider when they're thinking about transportation and their finances. And so, again, Layla said this in a few interviews, that the arrival and departure times, her biggest regret was not getting a data plan, so she didn't have to wait in the cold. It's always important to have a backup mode of transportation every time you travel. This was the last thing Jennifer said on the last day of this 15-day class. And the ones she listed were friends who can pick you up, Uber, Lyft, biking, and walking. So I already discussed biking and walking, so we're not going to talk about that anymore. But friends who can pick you up. Layla brought up the important point that if she doesn't have a phone plan, she can't call anyone to come pick her up, and she'll just have to like walk somewhere until she can find Wi-Fi and then call someone. And then Uber, I did some math. So Uber, if you're living here, and Exodus is here in the middle, that's $16 one way. And then if you want to go to work from there to there, that's $22 one way. And then you're going to have to double that if you want to get back home. So those aren't really viable options for refugees when they're trying to save money to pay for more important things in their lives. So what I found and what started this entire project for me is that refugees are buying cars illegally through friends of friends for about less than $1,000 and driving these for comfort and ease throughout the city to and from work, to pick up their kids from school, and so on. They said it saves them time and it saved them money. And so that's what started this project for me, was why are these refugees buying these cars and driving them illegally throughout the city? So because these cars are less than $1,000, they often have broken parts, which often cause risks, because cops in Indianapolis can identify these broken parts and see them on the road when refugees often don't notice them when they're buying them. And so then they get arrested and in trouble. And then everything that they just worked for kind of just failed for them when they drove this car. And this is not just special to Indianapolis. This is happening in Atlanta and Charlotte and Chicago and New York and everywhere. So this is a cycle that I see. If something is broken, everything else kind of breaks. But if everything is not broken, then everything works fine. It's like basic. Yeah. So these are a few of the barriers. I did not discuss childcare because Layla didn't have a child. But other refugees and organizations have discussed childcare as a barrier for them, where if a mother needs to work and all her children are under the age of 6, she can't watch the children. The children can't watch each other. So what is she going to do? So different solutions, and I'm going to talk about the ones that refugees themselves and organizations that work with refugees like Exodus and Morelli's group have come up for these different barriers. So with childcare, Exodus and Morelli's group have suggested that childcare should be done in a co-op situation where about 7 or 8 families all live in the same neighborhood, and the mothers take turns working on specific days. And so on their days off, what they'll do is they'll watch all the children in that neighborhood, and they'll just take turns, and each mother has a certain day off to do that. Everyone has said that would be the ideal solution, except for the refugees themselves, who have said they don't trust other mothers with their children to take care of. So that's just not going to work. And then the next one is transportation. Different solutions have been vanpooling, which is where organizations and companies will hire a van, or they will have the refugees with a driver's license get a van, rent a van, and drive a group of refugees up to their place of employment. It's worked a few times, like with Amazon, whose warehouse in Indianapolis is right next to SRAM's up there. So they will pick up Burmese refugees from Greenwood for Amazon and for SRAM, and then drive them up. So it works to that specific situation very well. But to others, like there's 90 employers in Indianapolis for refugees, and they all can't be able to afford the van pool situation. And so if refugees were wanting to do it themselves, like if someone wanted to buy a van and like maybe charge a dollar one way or something like that to work, that's fine, but the insurance for that is out of their price range, and they won't be able to afford the insurance, is the problem we saw with that. So other forms of transportation to fix it, this is the trickiest barrier we've come across, because no one I've talked to has come up with a great solution for it, but everyone thinks that it would be great if Indianapolis public transportation system would be able to extend their lines out into the suburbs like Greenwood and up there and everywhere, so that way everyone could have access to the transportation lines or the bus lines. But when I spoke with Indigo, they said that it wasn't possible and that they had Commuter Connect in Greenwood, but the refugees aren't able to afford the Commuter Connect to take them from Greenwood to the bus line. So that was a problem. And then language. There was a common solution to language among both organizations, voluntary agencies, employers, and refugees, which was amazing. And it's a mobile English as a new language class. So it's where someone rents a van and they take all their coursework and the textbooks and all the resources they need to the different refugee communities. So that way refugees don't have to go anywhere and face all these obstacles to be able to access English classes for them. So that would be great. I haven't seen anybody start to set that up yet, but hopefully it will start soon. And then for digital infrastructure, the only solution that Exodus was able to come up with, and Layla, was that refugees should be allowed to have, or Exodus should pay for a data plan for refugees for their first year when they're resettled. So that way they're able to adjust to life in a brand new city for them, and also have like translation, interpretation, and maps to fall back on their phone, so that way they're not lost or having miscommunication problems and everything. So right now, Exodus does pay for data plans and phone plans up to 3 months, but after 3 months, they don't have that anymore. And so that's something they usually cut out of their lives.
You have been listening to Infrastructure, Immobilities, Independence, and an Iraqi Refugee on Sitting Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Refugee Studies doctoral student Lydia Leahy present her paper on refugee resettlement in the Midwest. We now return to the second half of the program with Cheryl Dunier, Blurring Distinctions. On January 23rd, the Jorgensen Guest Filmmaker Program brought in the award-winning filmmaker to the IU Cinema for an on-stage interview with the director of the IU Black Film Center, Terry Francis. Today, you'll hear a 30-minute clip of the program. We now return to the show, with Cheryl Dunier and Terry Francis speaking about episodes of Queen Sugar, directed by Dunier.
So let's talk about the moment that you're in right now, as you see it. I mean, from my perspective, I remember I've been watching Queen Sugar. I wait for the episode to drop, And then, is it 6 a.m.? It's okay. It's going to be up now. Okay. It's time for me to watch it. And then I watch it through my blur of tears. I don't know what I'm crying about. It's not the story, I don't think. There's something, it's giving me something else, some feeling of reunion maybe or something. But seeing your name pop up on there, like someone from my syllabus, someone from that I was thinking of, you know, from the last, like 10 years ago, you know, you're teaching these films and they don't, and the students want to know, so what was next? Where are these people now? Like, well, I don't know. There was an HBO project. I don't know. And now we all know. And so it seems like a remarkably different moment. I wonder how you're experiencing it and how you account for it.
Thanks. It's a deep question. So I guess I would say that in making my early work, it was because I had to. Nobody else was making it. I just had to do it. And it was received for the people who needed to see it, who also needed to be recognized and acknowledged and then live their lives. But I feel like my work right now is moving beyond that and reaching people who not necessarily want to hear it, but it fits well. In particular, those in the African American community, because there was, you know, I'm not a person who ever was in the closet, ever, you know, hid any aspect of myself, and was always a maker that was out, that was, you know, making, you know, subjects about my life and the people that I loved and the conflicts that were in that. But and that allowed me to sort of stay on the outside and look in a way and kind of creep around the margins. But now I feel like with directing Episodic, it has just sliced me right into the center and any way that I want to get into the center. And who knows what the center is going to be. It's going to be me and others in that center. So the episodic world, which now is replacing that indie world, which is looking even for more powerful stories from the margins that are speaking a visual truth that had not been there. I mean, if you look at even the sense of Black cinema from, you know, its heyday, Black independent cinema in particular, from like Spike Lee time until, you know, through the 90s, even in the, especially the early 2000s, there was nothing like Queen Sugar. There was no place for a Queen Sugar to exist. There was no shows, you know, I don't even know what people go like, oh, the Cosby Show, that was about Black life. That didn't feel like me. That was not my Black life. I didn't have, you know, a mother and a father that danced around and, you know, flipped pancakes and did the things like that. I didn't have that Black life. So for people to say like, oh, the Cosby Show is representative of Black culture and that's the way it should be, I never saw that, you know. So Queen Sugar, and with this moment in Episodic, we are actually seeing shows where people walk up to me and say, I don't know what it is about Queen Sugar, but it feels Black. It looks Black. You know, it's about a certain Blackness that is, you know, conflict driven, without fathers, without mothers, with problems, with the day-to-day, with love. And I think that's what's really happening now. We are blessed as African Americans to have our seat at that table, though it was through a history of buffoonery and, you know, very negative representations of who we are. But we are allowed to, you know, make that table ourselves, sit at that table, say who can come to the table or not. And what I want to do right now, because I think there are other people that need to be at the table. Nobody's looking at Latino, Latina cinema. Nobody's looking at Asian American or Asian representation or any other parts of America that need to be at that table.
Yeah, Native American,
Just keep, you know, Muslim Americans, just yeah. Everybody. Just identities and races and American life that you don't have to listen to on NPR. You know, This American Life, which I have another issue about radio, but I'm not going to go into that right now. But definitely I feel like I'm able to, A, cut to that center and be at that table. And people are now listening to my ideas, which are still the same kooky, crazy ones that, you know, think that everybody should be at the table, that, you know, queerness is just another aspect of the table, that Black, you know, that it's intersected. But people are hearing it, people are wanting it, and people are, you know, slicing that up there on the experiences of who we are as, you know, producers and part of American culture.
Yeah, it definitely seems like the what I would have thought about 10 years ago as indie over here and commercial over here, or certainly Oprah over here and indie film over here, has really come together. Although the bridge, I think, was always there through her interest in literature, and which has only grown and kind of set a pathway where that Ava DuVernay could walk down with her own kind of ethic of this like collective, like her platform is an us, you know, in that sort of like Alice Julia Cooper, When and Where I Enter, you know, kind of ethic. I want to go back, though, for just a second to the type of like autobiographical work that you did early on, and because it's what moves me about that work is that although it is about you, it's also about us, and that it's you kind of looking out at the world, and that the later work is not autobiographical in the same way, but an interiority is still really important, and that can also be part of maybe what's so alluring and moving about the work on Queen Sugar too. I mean, I wonder how you think about that move from the interior outward.
Yeah, that's really deep, because I do think that the personal is political. You know, I do go back to the sort of mantras of Audre Lorde. You know, how we are doing our work, are you doing it too? All the poetry of June Jordan, of, you know, all, you know, just all the masters of who wrote about political life and identity, and how that, you know, they are separate, but they are, you know, an integral part of culture and cultural production. So I really do, you know, still carry that torch in a moment where, again, Hollywood, commercial wood, indie wood, all that really wants you to sort of stave off and, you know, make the film that looks like you. And I think what's happening now is you can make the film that feels like you, and you can be a whole bunch of different things. So that's why we're getting the few women that are coming in to direct who knows what. I mean, a variety of things. Women are, you know, slowly getting recognized for directing huge box office films, you know, with women at the center, but, you know, maybe a man made, you know, Wonder Woman up in his head for a variety of odd reasons, you know. But, you know, who flipped it out and, you know, making the money on it and making the American imagination of young and old believe in it again and have hope. So I really do think that that's part of what is the personal is political, and realizing that everybody's personal is political. Everybody's story is important, not just my own, not my own bubble of, there's just so many bubbles that are living collectively together. You are banging up against other people. You are, you know, somebody's bubble will be popped as you float by, you know, and what are you doing with that pop? And what are you that pop? And what are you doing with that float? And I think that, you know, for me, it's like I'm banging against something and, you know, just kind of continually, you know, floating until I, you know, pop into the ether and you know, hopefully leave a strong legacy for people to, you know, use, not just like, you know, not use, but use and have access to and have the language skills or have the visual language to deal with. And that's why it's so important for me as an artist to call myself an artist, call myself an academic, call myself a parent. I have a 19-year-old and an 18-year-old. I'm sure some of you are those ages in here. And letting those things, you know, sort of bump up on me and not trying to control them, but, you know, use them in my work and how I go on. So that's where I think it's starting to, you know, have a bigger heartbeat than just my own.
I want to pick up on something that Ava DuVernay said in her introduction to you, and she talked about how you have kind of set a model that that you're doing, you do things in your work that seem so commonplace now, and I think immediately of Issa Rae and her work with Insecure, but also the web series beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I'm so fascinated in that work by the themes of like a sexual being and a creative being kind of being molded together, that there isn't like that, you know, there's no like mind-body separation or some kind of like a priestly connection or commitment to creativity. I don't know, is that something that you've
noticed? Yeah, I mean, I think you're trying to get at like, you know, how do we put it, how is it all put together and how can you perform that either in your work or through your body? And I think Issa is a great example of somebody who lived the experience of her character in many ways and iterations and is able to perform them and is able to say, you know, I am the being that has done it, and I'm also empowering a whole slot of and slate of other people to do that. So for, you know, for Issa to be the awkward black woman, girl to woman to whatever she is now, she's, you know, her color correct thing, if you go online and look at, she just received a huge grant to empower others in media, just in media in general, to make work that deals with blurring this line. So, you know, the sort of autobiographical storytelling all the way back to slave narratives in text is sort of what we're seeing that's living right now in film, even Atlanta, even, you know, all these shows where they're pretty much the showrunner is the star, is the director, you know, and it's the world of these characters that are so necessary to take that risk to be out there, be it strong or weak or comedic. I mean, I think humor is a big aspect to some of my storytelling, though Queen Sugar wasn't filled with that type of humor, but definitely through Issa's work, through Atlanta. I'm trying to think of other shows that are out there. Anybody know any other shows that are doing that, audience? I know you guys are watching episodic. What other shows do you like that speak to this moment? Well, maybe they're working you too hard and you ain't watching no episodic. Okay, right? But the shows right now are like really trying to put ideas and lives and lifestyles into it. I mean, Orange is the New Black. I mean, who would have thought about women in prison other than me with a stranger inside? But definitely, you know, and how you can let that go. I'm not suing anybody. Like, all right, y'all take it. It's okay. It's all right. It's fine. I'm good. I'm good. It's enough. There's enough women in prison stories to tell, which is sad to say, that, you know, I'm not going to get hurt by it. But, you know, allowing to be an influencer of culture when I'm still alive and working. And I think that's really difficult to, like, say, oh, you know, what Issa said at the Golden Globes, it's like, I'm here rooting for everybody. I'm here about everybody and everything. I'm not here just about myself. I'm here about this moment and what this moment has created, and I want everyone to win. And I think that's a really, like, noble, difficult, not even difficult, wise thing to say. And I think that wisdom is starting to come out more and more within the openings that we're starting to see as the, you know, all the tin men fall away from Hollywood. These women are stepping in and saying, you know, I'm about a little bit of sunshine and a little bit of wine. And wine meaning drinking and crying, you know. There'll be tissues in the bathroom, you know. I'm saying it's allowing that all these feelings to happen because that's part of the story. It's not just sunshine. It's not just laughter. It's not just tap dancing. It's not just white or black. There's a lot of gray area. And I think that we're starting to, you know, wanting to hear and see works of art in literature, in storytelling of poets, slam, even how R&B has changed and hip hop has changed and rap has changed, and, you know, all cultural production is changing and it does not look the way it used to because we're wanting to hear about that gray area of emotion where most of us live. We're not all happy, we're not all sad, we're floating in between, and I think there's enough space and work and makers and the ones who are sort of, you know, living hard and standing by that gray are allowing that to kind of come shine through.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I'm trying to get at too is that erotic space, like how you kind of, I mean, both like on the level of how do you deal with desire, but also where comedy comes in and that unique, it seems more than satire, right? Because it's not that dismissal. It's something like, maybe there are these two lines in the beginning of Watermelon Woman, or when you start to think, when you're the character you, starts to talk about Faye and what draws you to her. And you say, something in the way she looks and moves is serious, is interesting. That feeling of being compelled and the allure of a subject. And then another character says later on about Faye, when she sang for us, she used her real name. We used to stand close to the stage so she could look at us. There's something so tender in that recognition and power and a powerful drive at the same time that seems to me to be what makes the imperative to make work, right? Like that. So it's about looking. It's about being seen by what you're looking at the same time.
Well, it's also, I think, about like, you know, we are complex beings. Lord have mercy. You know, we are so complex. Most of us were raised, you know, eating meat, and now we're vegetarians. You know, or you know, vegans, or and then we're back to eating meat again, or whatever. I mean, we're complex because we felt empathy for, you know, some doggy video we saw on our Facebook feed, or, you know, we actually saw somebody get killed, or, you know, who knows what impacts us to make our, or to feel our decisions, to smell our decisions, to heal our decisions, and to use them to, you know, move beyond and not lay frozen. And I think that generative feeling, the cells riding up against the anger, all those emotions that we go through, and being able to step outside of yourself and present them through creative work is what was Cheryl and most of my characters, motivates them to move outside of their, to go through their journey and their storytelling. So you know, humor was just for the Cheryl that I created in that film, which is very much like myself, Cheryl. You know, I never worked at a video store, but I wanted to. You know, that is my mom. And to use humor, I was a class clown in The Fool. I used humor to, you know, protect myself from the bullying and the, you know, racial insecurity I was feeling on my own head, as well as what was being put on me. So to speak in that way, that allowed me a certain sense of armor and relief and release. And also, you know, I got over on you in a way. And so that was my empowerment, and I could walk away from that and store it on, you know, put it on the shelf to use at a later time and just kind of navigate the world. So I think we're, you know, using Issa Rae and using this magical moment of like episodic humor and shows that are, you know, putting themselves and people that are putting themselves in this sort of storytelling is about how we can get over ourselves, yet use ourselves to stay in ourselves and move beyond ourselves at the same time. It's like a yo-yo. Like once you get the flow, you're not going to stop. You're just like yo-yoing all over the place until somebody says, put that down. You know, and you're like, no. So that drive to know that you are the boss, you are the, you know, the S word ending in T, that you can control things, and that others, in particular in this age of like the internet and media and social media, that you're not alone in that, that it's out, you know, that there's more outside of this bubble than just you. People are excited and screaming and wanting to see more, to do more, for more of it to reach in the gaming world, to more novels to be written, for more, you know, short novels, for poems, to, you know, more events, more cultural production where they can see themselves. And that's why we're seeing these floodgates open again in a way that hasn't ever happened before. I mean, to see two, you know, Asian American stars walk off a show because they're not being paid enough, Hawaii Five-0, and, you know, the world to start to think about that in a different way. Who knows if that show will get shut down? It probably will. That's amazing, you know, to see, you know, who knows what's going to happen to this thing with Black-ish and Tracee Ellis Ross not even being paid the same amount of money as Anthony Anderson. You know, that's amazing, you know, to be involved in a change that is about entertainment, about like, and entertainment equals cultural production for us today, because most of us live in those worlds. So to see those things get changed, see the billboard looking a little different, is what we need. And for us to play a part of it, to like it, to share it, to then to make it ourselves, because there's a lot of folks making work. We spoke yesterday about all the YouTubers and all the, you know, people making, you know, little mini films on Instagram and, you know, other social media sites. It's amazing how it's necessary and how other people are from around the globe are taking those, you know, same tactics and strategies. And yes, there will be, you know, bodies on the ground, but there's change is coming, and it's long overdue. I think the thing is making sure that you are bringing somebody else through that change window. And that's where I think we're starting to, and I think that's what's happening with women, is that we're bringing other people through that window with us. As many people can get, you know, through before that window closes is what I want to do. And rightly so, I think everybody should in their own fields. Nobody can be the master, the boss forever. And I think, you know, the king is dead, long live the king is sort of what has to happen. Like, we have to let go to grow. And that's where we're starting to see those women in power, like the Oprahs, even like the Avas, and you know, a ton of other people that I'm not really mentioning their names, are doing. They're just like saying, you know, it's not about me anymore. It's about who else I can get at this table, because I want to go to, you know, on vacation. I want to really retire at a certain point and enjoy and sit back and read the books and write the books and whatnot. Y'all could take the table. Y'all could cut the table up. I don't care, but I gave you the table, you know? So that's really where I'm at. It's like I've done a lot of work. I've been in, you know, fields by myself at night, alone and afraid and persecuted and called, you know, many things. You know, if I've cleared the field out, y'all go stand in the field. I'm going over into the sunshine for a moment. And I'll save a space for you in the sunshine, too. So I think that's what we have to, that's what, you know, legacy production is about. And so I'm not just, you know, using this moment to, you know, make work that points back to me. I don't even know what to do if everything kept pointing back to me. I would just like run and hide. Even about money, I think capitalism, as it's related to cultural production, is a very scary thing. I mean, all we have done is made gods out of the people who make culture in America. Every star, I don't know why we even, you know, half the people aren't as beautiful as they seem, and yet we hold them as this concept of beauty. You know, all the cover girls and the GQs, and it's like, that guy is ugly. You know, who put him up there? Why, what are you talking, you know, in my eyes, you know? So why are we paying them money just to, you know, walk on stage and walk off? You know, there needs to be more people on that stage. Need to be more looks. Just step aside. You know, Miss America is all of us. We're all Miss America. So I really do hope that infection gets sprayed out like skunk juice on somebody, and that, you know, there's no way to kind of get it off. It's like, all right, we'll all just smell like skunks.
You've been listening to award-winning filmmaker Cheryl Dunier speak with the director of the IU Black Film Center, Terry Francis, about the new queer cinema movement and the art of blurring the distinction between fiction and real life. Dunier visited the IU Cinema as part of the Jorgensen Guest Filmmaker Program.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.